Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. I am Lee Cantor, and I am joined in the studio with Mr. Stone Payton. How you doing, Stone?
Good morning, sir. I'm tired, to be perfectly candid with you. You know, we were hanging out at the aquarium last night with the women in technology, the WIT Connect, and it was a lot of fun. But, man, we got home a lot later than usual.
I know. And they did an interesting fundraiser. I had never seen it before, but it seems that chief information officers are difficult people to get a hold of.
Apparently, and they come at a real premium, don't they?
That's right. Right. And so at the WIT Connect event, what they do is auction off time with these people. And so they stand up there at a stage and they describe their resume of who they are, what company they're with. And then people bid on time with them.
So did you feel a little bit guilty at all? Because like they would bring in like $27,000 to spend some time with the chief information officer of Dell.
Whatever company, right.
And then they'd stroll over and sit down with us and chat for a half hour. And I'm sure if we called them, they'd come in the studio.
I don't know if they were expecting a check. Do you think they were expecting a check?
I certainly hope not. But it was a fun event, raising a lot of money for a good cause. And, you know, one of my favorite, I enjoyed all of them, but one of my favorite interviews was the mother and daughter team. And the lady that's going to that place I can't pronounce,
Abu Dhabi.
Prince of Abu Dhabi. So.
The only girl team in the robotics competition. They won the national competition and they're going to the international competition.
How cool is that?
It was very cool.
So, but not as cool as what we're doing this morning.
Not even close. So what we got today is we have Dr. Stephen Harmon, and he is with Georgia State University. He's the Director of Learning Technologies. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So have you ever heard of this outfit, this Women in Technology?
I haven't, no, but it sounds great. And you know, I'm thinking, though, whenever I talk to our CIO, it's trouble. So I'd pay money not to talk
not
to him.
Maybe next year they can go that way.
So it's interesting, though. I want to ask you, because we're coming off this event, apparently there is still a dearth in females, young females, going into technology. Is that your experience? Are there more males than females in your program?
That's an interesting question, and it reflects a blindness, I guess, on my part a little bit, because our program is split. We still have a lot of folks who are going into public education, so probably half of our folks are working in schools or school districts, and most of them are women. So I think if I were divided out, you know, by the folks that are in the corporate side or the folks that are in the school side, it may be that way. I don't notice it, but you could very well be right. I'll have to check.
So how did you fall into this line of work? Always been involved in technology, always involved in education?
No, I was an English literature major as an undergraduate and found...
you paid your dues.
I found I couldn't really get a job.
Really?
Yeah.
And English is your first language?
It is my first language, yeah. The literature part, I think, is what got me with that. But I was working actually for a company, Thompson Mitchell Associates, here in Atlanta, that distributes training films, produces training films, and... in the mailroom was the job I had. And I'd had a bad day at work one day, and a friend called me and said, "Hey, Steve, do you want to go teach English in Egypt?" And I said, "You bet." And
you bet.
Two weeks later, I moved to Upper Egypt for 2 years and taught English as a second language.
You know where Abu Dhabi is.
It's not in Egypt, but yes, I do.
Well, it's in the neighborhood.
It's in the neighborhood for that.
Is it in Africa?
No, it's the Middle East. It's in the Emirates, I think, right in the United Arab Emirates.
Look this up.
Anyway, so the good thing about teaching English was I had 5 months off in the summer, so I traveled down through the Great Rift Valley through Africa, and I was in Kenya, and I saw, you guys were maybe old enough, but maybe the listeners aren't, I saw a video disc, if you remember the big...
Like a laser disc.
And this is one that General Electric had produced that taught people how to repair diesel locomotive engines. And so you looked at the first screen, and it showed a bunch of different diesels.
So not only did you have a laser disc, you had a laser disc player?
There was a laser disc player.
Wow.
And it did not fit into your pocket.
No,
I don't think.
No, it did not. But I watched, and it taught these people how to repair locomotive engines, which is a huge problem in developing countries, is repairing those. I thought, that's cool. I want to do that. And so I went back and thought, well, who is it that does that? And I kind of hit upon instructional design as folks that do that. And so went to the American University of Cairo, took the GREs, applied to the University of Georgia, got accepted into the agricultural education program because I hit the wrong number. when I put it in, but eventually got it all worked out. Did my master's, went out to Apple Computer and worked for them for a while in their training support division in Cupertino, and got invited to come back and do my doctorate. And I thought, well, that's too good a deal if they're going to pay me to go to school. So,
now, what was it like working at Apple? What's the environment
interesting
there?
When I was there, John Scully was the CEO, and he was I used to row next to him every morning. We'd end up at the in the gym in the rowing machine, and I only represent high. At the time, Apple was going through a transition.
Right. So just for some perspective, sure. Scully was first. There was Jobs. Then they got rid of Jobs, and then Scully came on because he was a Pepsi guy, and he was supposed to rescue and make the
exactly
company
right.
more corporate-y and less kind of artsy.
Exactly right. And that led to, I think, the transition that was at my time was Apple was deciding whether they wanted to change the world one person at a time or make a lot of money. And
right.
they were fighting about that at the time.
So now, so you were there the whole time during Scully, so you never got to work with Jobs? Or
no, I was only there for not quite a year, about 8 months, uh-huh. and then Jobs was after that
right.
when I came.
So what's the day-to-day life of someone who holds a doctorate and is out at the university?
Oh, I get up about noon. And
nice, I like
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Play a little Frisbee.
Little Frisbee, sometimes I wear pants, but I don't know. No, it's a little different. I have multiple jobs. Georgia State is a research university, so I don't know if you know, research universities are divided out into different kinds. And Georgia State, Georgia Tech, University of Georgia, and Emory in the Atlanta area are the four research one or research intensive universities. So a lot of our job is research-based. If I'm not teaching classes, I'm working with doctoral students, or I'm doing research, and I also have some service responsibilities too as the director of learning technologies that I do that.
So what kind of projects are you working with that you're allowed to tell us about?
Are they secret?
Cold fusion.
Yeah, I always have secret projects so my boss doesn't know.
That's right. I'd like to help you, but yeah. I have the secret project that I'm working on.
No, right now I've got a very interesting project working with the CDC and the Institute of Public Health, and we are looking to train public health officers across the 50 states and 8 territories, I think it is, in chronic disease management. And they're trying to do this in an online format because these people are scattered all over the world. And it turns out because we're living longer than we used to, the problems that we used to face, we don't face them as much. And so the things that we used to die before they bothered us, now we're living long enough where they bother us.
Interesting perspective. Well, there has to be just a ton of applications for technology in the healthcare arena. You got the growing population. You've got all this legislation coming down the pike.
Yeah, healthcare is exploding. I mean, it's a huge thing. And what you see with it, I think, is part of what I do. The thing I like to do is think about how do we use new technologies in new ways. We traditionally use new technologies in old ways. You know, and for years we thought of the computer was a cross between a typewriter and a calculator. And finally, with the internet, we started getting out of that and seeing it a little different. But our fallback is horseless carriage. You know, we're thinking about new things in old terms. So I try to think, what can we do with new technologies in new ways? And right now, one of the things that's really coming out in the education and training sectors is the whole data mining. Marketing has been data mining for a long time. They're really good at it. But in education, we haven't been so good at looking at this tons of data that we can get. And
what kind of data are you talking about, and how would you use
sure,
it,
data
mining?
Yeah, data is about what students do, really, in terms of training. So we call it learning analytics because mm-hmm. we can't call it the
data mining. Sounds too like Big Brother.
Yeah, a little too harsh for that. So in learning analytics, so we're looking at every little thing the students do. If they're in an online learning management system, we're looking at which content did they go to, what order did they go to it, how long do they stay there, where do they go after they leave the content. Same sort of thing marketers look at. We don't know what to do with it very well yet, but we think we will eventually one day know what to do with it.
Now, that's interesting because I'm a big believer in having kids use more online resources. I think that that's a big gap in today. I have a middle school kid, and I see they don't use Khan Academy, and they don't use these online resources that are available that can really help support the teacher and make them do a better job. And in your world, this data mining element to this, you want more of that, it seems. The more data you have, the better you can mine it and get the information out.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we say that kids don't use computers in school, but they do use computers
exactly.
for school.
And after school, I'll
and
tell
and
you
after
that.
After school, exactly. And I have middle school kids, too. And, you know, when they get home, they're doing their work on the computer.
Right, exactly.
And so that's a systemic problem. Education has been so slow to change. Chris Deedy is at Harvard University and famously said once that if electricity were to somehow vanish tomorrow from the planet, education would be the least affected of society.
What a great quote.
And that's true, sadly.
Yeah, it is. So.
But you do feel like it's going to change in the nature of the way that we get our information, even through formal education, is going to lean more and more on technology?
When I started in graduate studies, I thought everybody here talked about the technology revolution, and I thought, well, that's I want to be a part of that. I want to do the technology revolution. But I had to do my own thing. So I thought, I'm not just going to study technology. I'm going to study revolution. And so I read Che Guevara and, you know, and all the revolutionary things. And the first thing I learned was that the leaders never wake up one day and say, let's all go shoot ourselves and let somebody else take over. That revolution always happens from the bottom up. And that's where we're going to be. Right? We're going to get there. But it's not really going to come from the structures that are in place now. It's going to be all the kids.
When you're saying the bottom up, the bottom isn't the teachers. The bottom is the students.
The bottom is the students.
Right. The students are going to force this change. And I think the teachers are going to go begrudgingly because technology, as we've seen in all industries, technology replaces people. Teachers are going to take the hit on this. I mean, there's going to be less teachers, and we're going to rely more on technology.
Well, you know, it replaces teachers that don't know how to deal with it. That if you're
there's going to be less in number. I mean, every technology company, they're so much more efficient in terms of manpower.
Right, right. I hope not. I hope what's going to happen is that teachers will be much more effective, and we'll see smaller class sizes. So you'll have a much more fluid structure in education. And you'll find teachers that do everything. You might have a teacher that specializes. Specialization may increase, actually.
Right.
Among
teachers. I think so, because now you can, if you believe in this virtual world and virtual learning like this, your kid can get the best instructor in the planet. Every kid can.
Right, right. That's an issue in higher education, too. I don't know if you are familiar with the open courseware projects that MIT has been doing.
And Stanford.
And Stanford. So Stanford did this artificial intelligence robotics course, and 160,000 students signed up for it.
Right.
That they had.
So they just really opened up access to it and made it.
It was free.
Affordable. Yeah, that's affordable.
Yeah.
Even I could work that into my budget.
You could work the free one.
But in Stanford, then the kids at Stanford were paying. And they would get course credit and a grade.
Right. And so with MIT, what they did, you know, with the open courseware along the same lines, they made everything free. But then they later came back and said, well, you know what? Now we'll do with MIT X. If you want to take a test, we'll give you a certificate that says you have mastered this content offered by MIT.
Wow. Right.
But they charge for the certificate.
Right.
And for the test. And that's where they...
But they're not charging as much as if you were an MIT student.
Right. Much cheaper for that. So the question in higher education, this has got university presidents panicked all over the country.
Well, I mean, if you're an employer, do you care if the person has a degree from MIT or they've passed every class in MIT?
Exactly.
With a certificate.
And so there's just a huge quality control issue in that.
Right.
In determining what happens. The jury's out.
Right.
Nobody knows. But universities are panicked because they're thinking, well, why would someone go to Georgia State when they can go to Harvard for free?
Right.
With that. And the reason I think that what we're coming up to is that you go to these other universities because you can directly interact with faculty and find out what the cutting-edge research is. So if you got 160,000 students in your class, you're not going to spend a lot of time with them if you're a faculty member. And I think that universities are going to get to that point. And my research focuses on synchronous online learning. Because I think that being able to act in real time with the students is something that is really going to be a benefit to them that they don't get in another way.
Now, I'm not a real student of history, but I have to believe this idea of a new technology, a new tool, a new something, wider access, and then immediate panic. That's got to be a pattern that's happened in history and repeated over and over. So I suspect we'll work our way through it. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, though... usually by the time they get to the panic stage, it's too late.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, well, I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of disruptive innovation. Mm-hmm. And that's Clayton Christensen, who's also at Harvard, wrote a book a long time ago about the innovator's dilemma. And it's about how companies really get supplanted by technologies. Mm-hmm. And he makes some good examples about digital photography. And now everything is sort of converging on our cellular phones and those devices. And the same thing's happening to universities in an extent. Universities are really robust institutions. I mean, I don't know if you can think of the oldest company you could name. I can't think of what it would be, like the Dutch East India Company or something. But
the Vatican?
Yeah, there you go. It's slightly different, but yeah, I see where you're going. But universities are older than that. You've got some universities that are 1,000 years old and still been around. So they take a long time to change, and they guard their domain, I guess, really well. But now I think they're facing a threat. More than they ever have before. So they'll have to adapt. They'll get there.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the synchronous learning?
Sure. But I'd be glad to. So synchronous learning is distance learning, and the students are all spread out. And
Stone's dad is a distance learner instructor.
Oh, yeah?
My father has a doctorate and was superintendent of schools for a pretty large school system down in Florida. Those school systems are big county systems. And then in his retirement, he's an adjunct professor at University of West Florida.
Ah.
And he has developed a real reputation for being really good at this one niche thing, school finance. And so if you want to do well in school finance and pass this test, you do what you can to get Dr. Payton's class. And that's all true. And it was funny, several years ago, your dad would, look, you can't do what I do over the internet. It's got to be live and all that. And it was really fun to watch the transition in that there is this live face-to-face component. But he is really capitalizing on the distance learning. And it's fun. Now he'll tell you with his chest sticking out, he's got students in Italy and all that stuff. And so he has, over time, really embraced this idea of doing some instruction and having some of it over the web. So that's what Lee's talking
about.
Well,
that's great, yeah. Well, that's a classic transition you see in universities. Universities typically say, okay, oh, wow, you know what? If we don't have to have classrooms, we can just have everybody log into a computer. We'll make a lot of money that way. Up your class sizes to 100 students, buy 100 students every time. Well, what happens when they do that, though? They're using an asynchronous model of distance learning, where the students and the instructor are separated both temporally by time and geographically by space. Faculty don't know how to teach that way. That's really tough to do. It being separated at a distance is much easier if you're doing it in the real time.
Mm-hmm.
So now universities are coming back to that, and I think one of the value added of universities, as I mentioned earlier, is real-time interaction with faculty. So I focus more on the synchronous online learning. That is, you're in real time with faculty members using some virtual sort of classroom. I use Illuminate. That's the one we use. Or you can use GoToMeeting, or there's lots of them out there.
So can you walk us through, like, what's that experience like for the student?
Well, I do something, for me, it's a little different. As you might expect.
You know, he says that on every...
I notice that.
There's something a little different about the way he does everything.
Pretty much.
I do things a little differently, generally. I smell differently, too. You can't tell that on radio.
So you're teaching, and they're able to interact. Can they tweet to you? Can they post questions live? Do you poll live?
We all log into a virtual space, a virtual classroom. And
are you in a classroom, actually, or are you in your house?
Well, I'm in my...
office.
Pajamas. I'm in my pajamas.
Not really? You can be anywhere?
It depends. I can be anywhere. I've done it. I mean, I've done it from all over. I've done it from a bar in South Africa. You know,
on your phone, or you have to be in front of a laptop?
I usually...
How's that for a recruiting tool for professors? Right. You can teach from a bar in South Africa.
Internet cafes work pretty well. Depends on your connection, how good your connection is.
So you need a good, solid internet. That's all.
I do it wirelessly. You know, I use it on my laptop a lot.
But you're finding specific value in it being synchronous, real-time. And then I'm operating under the impression, though, there also maybe asynchronously I can go get access to resources that supplement the synchronous activity.
Absolutely. So I changed the meaning a little bit of blended learning from meaning part face-to-face, part online. My blended learning is part asynchronous, part synchronous. So I've got an entire asynchronous course set up. And I've got activities and readings and assignments that the students do. But then every week we meet synchronously as well. So in that synchronous course.
Right.
So I have multi-channels of communication. So I've got sort of a whiteboard where we've got a PowerPoint communication. We've got real-time audio. And then we also have real-time messaging or chat. And so all of these channels of communications are going at the same time.
So, like, the screen is you in the center and maybe these windows around the edges?
You know, I haven't found a lot of value in people looking at me, so.
So you're not even on the screen.
I'm not even on
the screen.
He's
a research guy. He tests and measures.
It's your voice.
My voice. So, yeah, I mean, I actually do sometimes at the beginning of the class, I'll show a little video of myself or turn on the video so they can see me, so they think I'm a real person.
Right.
Because that helps. I mean, it sounds funny.
Well, and technology on this front, I know, is changing. My wife has a real job. She's with IBM. She's in the learning.
Yep.
And she has worked in some situations where she has described this to me, and she's invited me to see it. I haven't seen it, but the way she describes it is fascinating. She and her colleagues will be sitting at a conference table, and they're looking at this big screen, but she says, you feel like for all the world that those other three people are really in the room with you.
Yeah.
I forget what she calls it. You might even know what it is, but it's getting more and more realistic. you can be in South Africa, but you know, you look like you're right across the table from me, and so that technology is getting better.
That's
and
working
better
really
too.
Well. It hasn't got to the point for classes for me anyway, because let's say usually we have 30 students is kind of what we limit it to. So when you get right. 30 of those videos, it gets a little iffy.
You need a big screen, IMAX maybe.
But now, I mean, well, you couldn't do this 15 years ago, right? The pipes weren't big enough. It was too much delay and all that. So it's only going to get better. And smoother, right?
Oh, absolutely right. Yeah, that you one would hope.
Now, when you're teaching this class, are you polling to see if people really understand what's going on?
Sure. So I do a couple things.
And
so,
you can adjust accordingly?
Yeah. So I have I do use polls in the class. I'll have questions. So what I find interesting, though, is I can monitor the students' comments in the chat window. And they can comment to the whole class, to me, or to each other privately. But it's not private because I, as the instructor, can
see everything.
I see everything. So I actually use that as sort of a metacognitive dashboard, if you will, that I see the students' private comments, and I if they're talking about the ball game, I realize I'm losing them. And I gotta
right.
Or, but if they're asking questions about the content, then I say, I'm on them. So I measure them that way. And then the other thing I do is a little bit different. Sorry.
imagine that.
That's the theme.
One of the problems in distance learning is people dropping out. They feel like they're out there by themselves and they don't like it. And so there's been a lot of research on communities and building communities. And there's a model called the Community of Inquiry model by a guy named Winger. And one branch of that has to do with something called cognitive presence. It has three parts: cognitive presence, social presence, and teaching presence. But cognitive presence is the part I've kind of focused on. That has to do with how engaged you are mentally with the content. Most of the research on cognitive presence has been done on asynchronous discussion boards, and I've kind of turned it synchronously. So I capture all of the text, all of the transcripts from my online sessions, and then I go back and I analyze it for cognitive presence. In other words, I there's a scale, and I look to see how mentally engaged the students are in retrospect. It's a little more objective than just my judgment there.
And scary. I don't know if I'd want to do that with our interviews.
And you don't want your boss to see this either.
Yeah, exactly. It takes a long time. Oh, it's a lot of work to do. But what I found is, in general, the students are more engaged at a higher cognitive level than they are if they're doing a typical asynchronous discussion for that. So there are a lot of ways to check for knowledge or engagement.
So what's next for you? What's on the horizon next 6, 8, 10 months?
Well, yeah. Is there anything? Does this tie into ASTD in any way?
Well, sure. I mean, ASTD is a learning organization, you know, and it's about training. A lot of our students are ASTD type of folks, and we'll go there. So, from the one hand, hopefully, we're trying to move things along. We're trying to get folks to not do the same old thing in the same old way, because now there are possibilities to do it differently. So with ASTD, what we want our students to see is, you guys, I'm sure, are familiar with it, the ivory tower notion of universities and nothing we do.
No, I have never heard that before. Yeah. What is that?
That's you know.
What
that's,
is that you say?
That's
about
my job.
An ivory tower.
That's my job as a professor, to give you new things like that. No, but what ASTD is where the rubber hits the road, is the way I see it, really. And that's where our students can take some of these ideas they're learning and apply them in a practical way, and then talk to the folks who are out there who really know what they're doing on the day-to-day level and say, well, you know, in theory, that sounds great, but in practice, maybe not so much. And so we really see ASTD as the proving ground, I guess, for a lot of the work that we do.
So you work in partnership? You have any formal relationship, or is this more informal?
Well, it's more informal. Some of our students are members. I've been engaged with ASTD for many years. Right now, I'm not. Right now, I'm the president-elect of the Association for Educational Communications and Technology, which is kind of in the same realm, but is more of a research-based organization.
But you're going to get in there and do
things
differently.
Do you need an application for the ASD?
Yeah.
You need an application? Is that what happened?
Yeah, I got rejected, actually, is what happened. They said, he's too different.
So now, what's next for you now?
Well, I'm as I mentioned, this ASTD, AECT organization is beginning to take some time working on that. That has been interesting, too, to look at the different markets and look at how it relates to AECT and the other organization. Finishing up this grant with the CDC and the Institute for Public Health on training the...
Now, do you write the grants, or you've got people in your team
that
write?
No, he's got a kid. There's some 20-year-old that's doing the grants.
It's a mix. It's a mix.
No,
of
but
that.
That's a whole skill set. Writing a grant is not you can be a good writer and not be a good grant writer.
Well, you know, universities, that's the first thing they train people is train them to be grant writers.
They push it a lot. They really do, and it is learning how to do it. You know, figuring out how and figuring out stuff you can actually do. That,
right.
The worst thing is to write a grant you can't possibly fulfill. and not that I've ever done that, but I imagine it would feel really bad.
You've heard rumors to the effect that that happens.
So, but the new area that I'm moving into, as we talked about earlier, is this learning analytics, the data mining stuff. I'm continuing my work in cognitive presence, but trying to understand how we can continue to take advantage of new technologies and use them. That's what I'm about.
Now, when you're doing this kind of research for that kind of learning, do you want to work with organizations and companies to get their, to mine an actual, in the wild kind of situation,
or is it
university based?
I love working with companies because I find them easier to work with.
Bureaucracy.
Less bureaucracy. If you have an idea at a university or with a school system, you right off the bat, it's 8 months before you can sort of negotiate the wallet. With the companies, they say,
Go ahead.
Do you need that tomorrow?
We'll take a shot.
And you jump in.
So what type of companies would you be interested in working with?
Well, any companies who are doing online distance learning type of things.
Like what's an example of a company that does that?
All of them.
All of them? So that narrows it down.
That narrows it down. I think, we have...
Is it better in technology? Is it better in manufacturing? Is there a certain kind of industries that this aligns better with?
I'm trying to think. We've worked with tons of companies, Delta and UPS and Coke and CDC is not exactly a company, but they count. Orkin, any company that has a learning institution or a sort of university, they take it seriously.
Right.
And companies that are just kind of pretending to do training or online learning, not so much. But companies are serious about it and really see the value in enhancing their employees' skills. That's the ones we like to work with.
And then you can work with them and you can kind of test out this the synchronous learning and the mining of the data.
Right, exactly right. Now, the companies have to understand that sometimes we don't get it right on the first try.
Sure.
But in a sense, the stakes
What's in it for them, then?
Well, what they get is perhaps a new method of doing training that's more effective
that's
and
more
efficient.
That's more effective, right?
Yeah. I mean, usually the traditional instructional design models cut training time by two-thirds if you do them right, if you haven't done it that way, and with at least the same effectiveness for that. So hopefully we continue.
So are these formally structured programs, or you just go hang out with these guys and create something?
He does things differently.
Yeah.
I get that.
I usually stand on the street and wait for somebody to come by.
We'll data mine for food, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or you get a topic or something on your mind, and then you say, you know what, I'm going to go hang out. I'm going to go talk to the Coke guys and UPS guys and see if they're interested in pursuing this.
A lot of time it comes from our students. Most of our students are working with these companies already, so they've got the relationships, or we have them because we've been working with them a long time. So we'll say, hey, I know you're working at Orkin. What if we tried this in some of your training courses? And they say, oh, that sounds pretty good.
You talk about a learning-oriented organization. I'm going to tell myself on years now, but it's probably been a good 20-plus years. We put some sales training into the Rollins organization. The old man, Rollins, sat and watched every frame of videotape before they signed a deal. I mean, they are very, and have been for years, very invested in
exactly
learning.
Exactly right. Yeah. You can tell.
What a great organization.
Some of them are really super at it to do that. Yeah.
And now, if somebody wanted to learn more about what you're up to, you have a website?
I do. I have my personal website is swharmon, H-A-R-M-O-N, at gsu.edu.
And that's your email, right?
My email is the same thing.
Right.
That's not the website. However you say websites is what the website is. No at.
Okay.
It's dots. But then our actual program, if you're interested, we offer our Master's of Science degree in Instructional Design and Technology completely online. And that's at edtech.gsu.edu. And so go there. We also offer our PhD. That's not online. You have to come down to campus sometimes.
Old
that.
School.
You have to show up for
old
that
school
one.
In person.
But also shoot me an email, and I'd be happy to correspond with whoever's interested in finding out more.
So what can we do to help you most? Is it as far as us as a media property or our listeners, is it get the word out about the kind of work that you're doing? Is it help you make connections with some of these corporate folks, or just send really bright, passionate people through your programs? Or what's the way we can help you the most?
Do you have money?
Write a check.
Lee's loaded.
No, all those things are great. I think what we want to do is really strengthen the relationship between us and corporate folks, but also with us in ASTD. So we want to really make sure that the ASTD membership realizes that, particularly if you're in the Atlanta area, that there's a world-class ID program right here that you could take advantage of, not just if you're interested in further degrees, but we hope you are, but also if you're interested in research opportunities or internships. Our students do internships all over the country. for that. So that's another great area.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Stephen Harmon with Georgia State University. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio and the ASTD Workplace Learning Special.